This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
Our guest today on Digging in the Dirt is E. Hardy Kern III, the Director of Government Relations, Pesticides, and Birds Campaign for the American Bird Conservancy. The American Bird Conservancy is a nonprofit membership organization with the mission of conserving wild birds and their habitats throughout the Americas. Its focus is on threats to birds in the Western Hemisphere, threats which include overuse of pesticides, urban sprawl, habitat destruction, and invasive species. I had the good fortune to hear Hardy speak at the Neonics, the new DDT pesticide conference, recently held up in Hartford, and knew that you, my listeners, would be highly interested in what Hardy has to say about birds. Welcome, Mr. Kern.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Really, really grateful to be here and was so glad to connect with you at the conference a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it and you gave a great speech. That's why you're here today. So there's so much to talk about when talking about birds. Why don't we start with you giving us your assessment of the situation? Let's call it a state of the union for birds in the U.S.
That's perfect. That sounds great. So the best place to start, I think, here is in 2019, there was a report published, a paper published in the journal Science, very highly regarded, and it was called The Decline of the North American Avifauna, which is just a fancy way of saying birds in North America aren't doing so hot. And they found that there is about 3 billion fewer birds this year, or in that year, I should say, in 2019, than there were in 1970. That's about a 25% decline in North American birds in a relatively short period of time. And the paper goes on not only to talk about how it came to that conclusion, but also pointed out some potential culprits as to what could be causing this. And of course, there are things such as climate change and habitat loss that are identified, things like birds striking glass windows and building, things like introduced predators, such as cats and other things along those lines. But one of the big ones that was called out was pesticides. And that is where my work comes into play. There are about 12,000 different chemicals that are registered in the United States right now that are used as pesticides, and a big portion of those may contribute to environmental factors that lead to the decline of birds, either from birds being directly exposed to some chemicals used outdoors, or a little bit more indirectly, such as chemicals that lead to bugs being lost in the environment. I know a lot of people might not like bugs, but I'm assuming with a show called Digging in the Dirt, we've got a lot of pro-bug people listening here. I know that that's not a far stretch to make with your audience, Kevin.
Yeah, well, it is an interesting thing because we encourage everybody to rewild, and that's what I did in my backyard. I mean, I'm really pleased to see a resurgence of birds in my own yard. I mean,
yeah,
I just when I start putting in more pollinator-friendly plants that are, because I'm sort of selfish. I grow tomatoes, so I want them pollinated, and I put in those plants, but they had the other effect of having birds come back into the yard. So I have a good population of cardinals. I love my cat birds. The jays don't like anybody, but you know, they're good to see around. Woodpeckers, you know, and of course, good population of sparrows as well. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah. And I don't use pesticides. So is it your premise and the Conservancy's premise that if you stop using these pesticides, they can bounce back pretty readily?
Very much so, yeah. There have been a lot of studies done on areas where they have stopped using pesticides and then rewilded an area such as a converted farmland or a farm that's gone organic or parkland or forest land, you name it, that stopped using these chemicals. And they see exactly what you see, Kevin. They see birds coming back into those areas almost overnight, not to be too exaggerative, but when you start encouraging local biodiversity, the flora and fauna that's quote unquote supposed to be there, and you take out these often unnecessary limiting factors, which are pesticides, you see nature moving back in. We see the beneficial insects bounce back. We see the plants that some people might call weeds that we don't want to see in our pristine green deserts, which is what I call most of our lawns that we use. You see these birds coming back. And so A lot of the work that I do is focused on the larger scale problems. So I work with the US Department of Agriculture and the EPA to tackle some of these large scale regulatory issues. But one of the best ways to really make a difference is exactly what you're doing. It's to limit the use of pesticides in your own home and in the places that you have a bit of control or sway over. Every little bit counts. And there's been some really phenomenal work done at the global level, looking at small areas of really high quality habitat, basically people that have turned yards or parks into less toxic areas or more rewilded areas. And they tend to have an incredible amount of biodiversity that comes in just a few weeks and it stays there. You know, birds are really great, especially the migratory species, at kind of checking a box in their mind when they come to an area that is high quality habitat. So good food, good shelter, not a lot of introduced predators hanging out there. And they'll remember that and then stop there on their way to and from. Your local birds will learn pretty quickly that there's some tasty bugs in this area. There's some really great plants that I can make a nest out of, or I'm going to keep an eye on that coneflower because it's a pretty bloom right now. But in a few months here, it's going to be full of seeds that I can come back and eat. So it's a fantastic way to encourage local biodiversity. And our premise to boil it down, I suppose, is to reduce synthetic pesticide use as much as possible. We aren't saying that we want everybody's homes to be overrun and, you know, ants and termites, and that we should never turn to chemical pesticides. There are certainly situations that call for them for public health or for economic safety in some situations. But yeah, by and large, reduce your use as much as you can.
So, what's the problem with neonics, neonicotinoids? Are they special in some way that they are worrisome?
They sure are. They are special in a bad way. They are special in that they stand apart from the crowd as this is the one that we really, really need to be worried about. We need to be worried about all of them to some extent, but neonicotinoids are really the higher blade of grass that we need to look at when we're talking about different chemical pesticides. And just a little bit of background on them. They were first developed in Japan in the late 80s. And basically, the chemical market at the time was looking for an insecticide, so something meant to kill insects, mostly on crops in large scale monocultures such as corn and soybean and wheat. And the idea was to come up with a chemical that was really highly toxic in very small amounts. And a common way that insecticides work is as neurotoxins, where when a bug is exposed to them or a pest of some sort is exposed to them, this chemical has compounds in it that slot into the receptors in an insect's nervous system that are normally used for contracting muscles or organ function. And after being exposed to just a teeny tiny amount, the bug will die and no longer be a crop pest. Developed in Japan in the late 80s, first came into the US in the early 90s. 1994 was when we started to see some commercial applications. But neonics, as they're commonly called, if you will, didn't really take off in the United States until about 10 years later, about 2004, we really started to see an uptick. And then a lot of folks realized that these could be a great thing to use as a seed coating. So when you plant your corn or your soybeans or your wheat or your cotton or your potatoes or your sugar beets or you name it, there's an idea that as a little bit of extra insurance, just to make sure that nothing's going to mess with my seedling, I'm going to put some chemical on the outside of my seed. I'm going to plant it in the ground. And then when that plant starts to grow, a neonicotinoid is not only going to be on the seed, it actually gets grown into every single part of the plant. So the tissues, the stem, the leaves, the fruit, even the pollen and the nectar all contain an amount of this chemical. If you're a predatory aphid that comes along and bites it, you're going to get sick and die. That's the whole idea. But if you're a hummingbird that sips the nectar, if you're a bird that comes down and picks up one of these seeds that's been freshly planted, you are going to get exposed to that chemical. And the way that they work is they're really, really water soluble. They're meant to slough off of that seed after it's planted. And then when the seedling sprouts roots and starts to grow, it sucks that chemical up from the surrounding water. Only about 1 to 3% of that chemical actually makes it into the plant. The rest of it goes into soil, into groundwater. It gets lost as dust during planting. And when it's in the local waterways, it continues doing what it does best, which is to kill invertebrates. So it doesn't care if you are an introduced predatory aphid, a corn rootworm, or a native dragonfly. It's going to have the same effect. So what makes neonics so outstandingly bad, and why they're being talked about so much, why there was an entire conference that was just established around them, is that they are much more toxic in very small amounts than your average insecticide. And our delivery system for them, which is on seeds, far exceeds any other use of them in common agriculture in our homes. So they do get sprayed out of sprayers. They do get, put in our homes and insecticides that we might buy to take care of ants and termites and things. But the real problem is that they are put on seeds, which makes them such a great delivery vehicle to every single part of the country that is growing crops in large scale. So you get a high exposure, you get cross-country applications. You get a chemical that really likes water, so it travels away from the farm really easily, or the golf course, or the lawn. And you get something that's really highly toxic in very, very small amounts. So those four elements are the magic ingredients, the magic formula that makes neonicotinoids such a big problem right now for birds and for other wildlife.
Wow. Almost depressing. How many types of neonics are there? I mean, and are they all equally lethal?
Great question. There are right now registered in the United States 6 to 8, depending on what kind of application you're looking at, different neonics that are registered. And if you want to impress your friends at parties or, like me, get really good at Scrabble, here's some good names for you. They are acetamiprid, dinotefuran, thiamethoxam, clothianidin, imidacloprid, and acetamiprid are the big six that you need to worry about. And we have those names written down on our website, and I can share some stuff with you. So no need to grab a pen for anybody listening out there. But those are the big six that are used most often in agriculture. Thiamethoxam and clothianidin in particular are very commonly used as seed treatments, and imidacloprid is a very commonly used chemical for golf courses and lawns and parks and things like that. So those are the big three to really watch out for, and they vary in their toxicity, but the important thing is they all work in the same way. They all have the same method of action, so they all pose pretty much the same amount of risk when they're put on a seed or applied to a plant.
We're talking to Hardy Kern of the American Bird Conservancy, and he is talking to us about neonics. It's abcbirds.org if they want to find more information.
Yes, sir. abcbirds.org.
Okay, great. Is it accurate to say that one neonic seed is lethal enough to kill a songbird?
That's correct. Yeah, that is some work that we did back in 2013. There is enough toxic chemical on the outside of something as small as a seed of corn or two canola seeds. Two of those eaten has enough lethal ingredient to kill a songbird. And even more crazy than that, there is enough active ingredient on one single corn seed to kill 80,000 bees. Eight with four zeros after it. 80,000 bees can be killed with the amount of chemical that's on just one single seed of corn.
Wow, and it's amazing because so many collapses of hives now that it's a wonder that it's not even happening more with that kind of information.
Exactly.
Huh. So an interesting thing that you said at the conference we were at, you said that these chemicals also have unintended results, for instance, with slugs. Could you tell the slug story?
Yeah, the slug story is so interesting, and it really illustrates why we need to have much better testing before these chemicals are ever registered or permitted for use by the Environmental Protection Agency. So neonics, like we were talking about, they're insecticides. Their job is to kill bugs, and that's a job that they do very, very well. There was an issue, however, where there was a field rather that was seeded with soybean seeds that had a neonicotinoid on the outside of them. And the target there was to make sure that rootworms and some grubs and some very early crop pests didn't interfere. Unfortunately, in this field, what wound up happening is there were actually more pests in this particular field than there would have been had the neonics not been applied. Because what happened was when the neonicotinoids were applied onto the seeds, they started to get into the soil where they were then absorbed by slugs. And the slugs basically did not succumb to them at all. They were not really affected by the neonics. However, some of the things that ate slugs, which were predatory wasps that started to eat the slugs, got exposed to the neonic and they died. When there were fewer predatory wasps, they don't just eat the slugs, they eat a lot of the crop pests as well. So there's less things that are out there to eat the crop pests, which meant that there were way more crop pests, way more aphids than if they had not applied these neonicotinoids at all. So not only did we have this massive influx of chemicals into the environment, not only did they make their way into non-target organisms, these beneficial native predatory wasp species, the use of these chemicals increased the amount of crop pests in these fields rather than doing their quote unquote job and decreasing them. And we see unintended stories like that with neonics all the time. Another great one, I'll bring it back to birds if you'll permit. In
Absolutely.
laboratory settings, birds will be exposed to neonics as part of regular testing. Usually, this is done by a gavage method where they're sort of force-fed the chemical, and then scientists watch and see what happens with them. And they find a point where, this certain amount of chemical on a seed or on a spray is lethal to birds in this amount. So they recommend, okay, we want you to apply it at smaller than this concentrations. That's fine in the laboratory setting, but out in the wild, just because you don't initially die from being exposed to this chemical doesn't mean that there's going to be, you're scot-free and you're fine to just go on with your little birdie life. They have found in wild birds that have been exposed to these chemicals that they are unable to navigate, so they can't fly north or south for the winter. They don't keep body weight on as well as birds that were not exposed to the chemicals. They lose the ability to reproduce. There's been some issues with spermatogenesis in some of the male species of bird that they've looked at. There's just, I could go on and on and on. And the issue is, these things don't show up in laboratory studies. These things only come up in the wild when the environment has been exposed to these chemicals for long periods of time. So we have to look past the laboratory studies to get a full picture of what is happening with these chemicals. And when you do that, because we have close to 20 years of data on this now, you have a very, very dire picture painted. And it's an area that is, like you said, it's a bit depressing. It's not always the most happy area to work in, but it's one where we can get people involved. They can take matters into their own hands in their everyday lives. And so there's a lot of good to be done here. It's a very exciting field to work in.
Oh, sounds like it. I know that New York just passed some laws to restrict neonics, but I know Connecticut's just died. They just, in fact, they're not passing any bills in Connecticut. It's another one of those
Oh, yeah.
dysfunctional government organs that, and it's in Connecticut, folks. So your so-called leaders are not doing their job in Connecticut. But is there other chemicals that are going to be regulated or that we should worry about besides neonics? I mean, is glyphosate, for instance, or some other one that you know of that is an issue that you're working on?
Absolutely. So glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, the commonly used weed killer, an excellent chemical to avoid if you are killing weeds at your own property. There are also some rodenticide chemicals, things that you buy to get rid of mice and rats that might be around your home or your business. There are some chemicals, particularly ones in groupings that are anticoagulant, meaning they work by preventing blood from, kind of clotting up in an organism's normal body function. And what happens is they're a great way to kill a mouse or a rat. Unfortunately, when something eats that mouse or rat, like a hawk or an owl, or in some cases, maybe the family pet, those properties are transferred up to that organism and they might succumb to them themselves. So we work on basically just a more conscious, a little bit more responsible use of rodenticides. We work on a wide variety of herbicides as well, but neonics take up most of my time right now.
Sure. So just because I know people who have had issues with rats, for instance,
Yeah.
what do you recommend if you want to be concerned about that? I can see where you're talking about. You know, if you kill a mouse or a rat with that with something that's kills them, they could also kill the birds. So is there
Right.
anything that you can kill the rats with that's not going to affect the birds?
So the number one thing you can do to cut down on rodent infestations, and this is much easier said than done, I realize this, is to find how they're getting into your property and what is drawing them there. Is there food or seeds or something that they have access to? Are there holes in your foundation or a door that accidentally gets left open or something like that? Can you keep them out? I've been lucky enough to actually go around to people's residential and commercial properties with pesticide applicators and exterminators and see what they do. And about 80% of the most effective stuff you can do is to find what is attracting the rodents in and how they're getting there, and to the best of your ability, blocking it up. Past that, if you can use a mechanical mouse trap or rat trap, something like a snap trap, those can be very, very effective when they are placed well. There's a lot of really great information available on our website, as well as Purdue Pest Management. Purdue University has great stuff on this. There is other chemicals that you can buy. There's a product called Rat X, which is something you can buy on Amazon. It's just RAT, then the letter X. And it is still very much lethal to rodents. But if something else eats that rodent, they won't experience any other side effects.
That's
And
good.
the biggest thing that I'll say is just, try to be as conscientious as possible. If you're in a situation where rodents are really causing a problem for your business or your family, or you're worried about health effects, I'm not saying to not try to do something about it, but where you're placing your mouse or your rat bait is potentially very impactful on non-target species. If you're putting it outside, make sure that it is in something that an animal like a raccoon or an opossum can't get into and accidentally get exposed to that way. And like I said, try to plug up any entry or exit points that the rodents might be using as much as possible. So it's a difficult balancing act here. So it's a complicated issue, but one that I'm so glad to get to work on and grateful to have the opportunity to talk about with you today, Kev.
Yeah, well, and you also, folks, if you need more information, abcbirds.org,
Yeah.
you can get more information there about things that Artie's talking about. You know, I know you're pesticides and everything, but can't let you go without commenting on cats. I understand that your colleague is one of the most unpopular people in your organization because
He is.
he deals with cats. What do you have to say about cats? I can't believe that they estimate approximately 2.4 billion birds are killed every year. Is that
Yeah.
true? By cats?
Yes, sir.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's a very complex issue to be sure. The bottom line is cats are predators. They are very good at stalking and catching prey. If that is inside your house, that might be, a rodent that escapes in that way, or it might be the little feathery toy that you have for them. When they have access to the outdoors, though, unsupervised and when it's unrestricted, so just free roaming cats, they continue to exercise that instinct and they kill a lot of native wildlife, especially birds. And there's been a lot of scientific work done on this where they find that cats will kill and eat wildlife, especially birds and small reptiles, even when they're not hungry. They had a really interesting study where they actually basically just attached little cameras, almost like the cameras that you'll see police officers wearing. They put it on a cat collar for free roaming cats, and they found that only about 20% of the things that they killed actually got brought back to wherever that cat was living at the time. So they'll kill things and just leave them out there, not always to eat them. So as much as you can, keep your cats indoors. Build a catio if you're able to. There are cat strollers. There are cat leashes and harnesses that you can do. My in-laws have a really great system where they have little rollers on top of their fence in their backyard. So they let their cat out supervised. She can't climb over the fence, and when they go inside, they bring the cat back with them. So best of both worlds. It's
Yeah.
certainly an issue that a lot of people feel very passionately about. It's very understandable, but bottom line is cats that are outdoors kill a lot of native wildlife. So keep them inside. And if you let them outside, have it be on a leash, in a stroller, a catio, some way that you can keep an eye on them. It's definitely a contentious issue because people love birds and people love cats, and
Right.
sometimes they don't always get along so well.
Yeah, when I read this, I said, and I heard you speak about it, I cannot believe in it. It changed my opinion of feral cats. So, yeah, I'm
Yeah.
definitely for keeping a house cat, basically.
Yeah.
So we are running out of time here. So let's talk briefly about what can you do to help birds, populate your yard. Is there anything that you recommend as far as planting? Like Doug Tallamy says, he thinks the white oak, if you plant white oaks there, it's just an amazing tree for all the birds to live in and use and get caterpillars and all that. So is there anything else that you might want to recommend that people could do?
Definitely. But white oaks are fantastic. Spice bush is another really good one that hosts a lot of native caterpillar species. I tend to put bird houses and bird feeders up next to my vegetable garden. Like I grow tomatoes at home, just like you do. And I find that the birds will actually go in and pick off the caterpillars and anything else that are, preying on my tomato plants and my zucchini. So that's really helpful. If you plant any type of native flower, so cone flowers, different varieties of daisies, I know it doesn't always look the prettiest, but if you can let them go all the way to seed, so after the flower itself is kind of wilted and becomes kind of brown looking, birds love to come down and eat those seeds. Same goes with sunflowers that you grow in your backyard. And as much as you can, yeah, just plant native habitat and avoid using chemicals as much as possible. That includes lawn chemicals, weed chemicals. There's tons of different ways you can go out and still remove that pesky crabgrass. Or one of my favorite ones is I have a sidewalk that runs in front of our house, and there's weeds that grow up in between those cracks and drives me nuts. And so what I do is I actually just take my tea kettle full of hot water. I handle it carefully. Kids, don't try this at home without adult supervision. And I just dump boiling water right on top of them and it kills it. And then the next day I go out and I pluck out the weed that easily. So
Sure. Good
yeah,
solution.
there's so many ways you can help.
Sure. So, what about turning the tide about these chemicals? You work hard and you're rubbing shoulders with all the industry, I'm sure, and government
Oh
people.
yeah.
What's your assessment of are we going to be able to turn this tide around and stop the chemical error that I think it is, and try to do things a lot more naturally and still get the results that people want? I know farmers can, bristle when you say, "Oh, you can't use a chemical," and they feel like it's going to ruin their crops. What's your assessment of it?
So my number one takeaway to people is if this is something that you are concerned about, talk to your representatives, your state reps, your municipal reps, your federal senator, your federal congressperson. Let them know that this is something that you care about and they will put it on their radar. There's pieces of federal legislation addressing this, but most of it comes down to what the Environmental Protection Agency does and how they regulate things. And I will say, not necessarily farmers, but perhaps the representatives from large chemical companies and the grower groups will all get together. So, the different large commodity crop groups, they are very good at getting the message out that more chemicals and more applications are better, but their bottom lines as a chemical manufacturer is tied to selling more chemicals. So, of course, that's their line. And they'll talk to regulators. We talk to regulators about our side of things. But when people make their voices known that this is something they're worried about, this is what they want to see action taken on, that's when the federal agencies respond. So absolutely use your voice. And in terms of turning the tide, I'd say it's much more like turning a battle carrier than it is turning a rowboat. The wheels of government turn slowly, things happen incrementally. But the current Environmental Protection Agency we have in Washington, D.C., is more progressive and activistic with chemicals than any of their predecessors. They're really trying to do a good job, and we're trying to help them out when we can and let them know that we don't like it when we don't love it. So it's happening slowly, but it is happening. There's actually three different regulatory cases right now on neonicotinoids alone that we're actively participating in. And sort of sitting across the table from some of the grower groups and chemical manufacturers. So we're the other voice in the room, and we're very glad to be.
Yeah, thank God you're there. Yeah, I just saw an article yesterday. I added it to my, I have a series I call Gaiagram where we do environmental stories.
Yeah.
And they said that there's forever chemicals in everything. And
Yeah.
there's 12,000 of them, and there has been a study done on 12 of them.
Yep.
And this is pretty much par for the course, right?
Yep. Very much so, unfortunately. It's taken a long time to sort of get things going in gear, but we're now that the ball is slowly rolling, we want to keep it in motion.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. I find it very interesting, and your work is really important because we just can't do without birds and insects. So, this is important stuff. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. And remember, we can all do something in our everyday lives to help out local wildlife.
Great. My guest today has been E. Hardy Kern, the third, the Director of Government Relations, Pesticides and Birds Campaign for the American Bird Conservancy.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.